Hello and welcome to episode 16 in the series of podcasts featuring university registrars talking about stuff. This time I'm talking to Joanne Clegg, who's registrar and chief operating officer at Queen's University Belfast, about a wide range of topics both pre and post pandemic. We learn a bit about Joanne's background and how she spurned auditing as a career to pursue a varied pathway through many different areas of professional services in higher education, and also enjoyed a particularly valuable experience in the NHS, where she picked up a real taste for innovation and partnership, which has translated well into her current role. We also explore the many challenges of lockdown and the phased return to work for professional services staff, along with the strategies for trying to plan for different ways of working in the future, along with helping to promote wellbeing for staff. The likely campus experience for students arriving in September is discussed, along with the likelihood or otherwise of anyone hitting their international student recruitment targets. Finally, we look at the distinctive case of higher education in Northern Ireland and what the future holds for universities there and in the sector more broadly. Note that the vagaries of my broadband connection mean that some of the comments I make may occasionally sound a little bit wobbly. Sorry about that, and I hope it doesn't spoil your enjoyment too, as there is much here to like. Welcome, everyone. It's great to be back, and a real pleasure this time to introduce Joanne Clegg, who is Registrar and Chief Operating Officer at Queen's University Belfast. So welcome, Joanne. It's great to speak to you. And as a kickoff, it would be really helpful for me to hear a little bit about your background and how you ended up at Queen's University Belfast, where I think you've been registrar and COO there for just over a year. So how did you end up there?
Yeah, hello, Paul. Thank you, and great to join in this conversation with you. So I'll tell you a little bit about how I got into the HE sector initially, and then perhaps how I've ended up specifically in this role here at Belfast. So initially, on leaving university, I went to work at Deloitte's, a training contract to train to be a chartered accountant. And I was working within the audit function there. And I have to say, whilst that was a fabulous grounding for all that I have done in my career since, it was very clear to me early on that I didn't want to spend my life being an auditor. And for me personally, there was very little job satisfaction in that. A little bit of travel, but not the kind of glamour that you might associate with a jet-setting chartered accountant. There was a lot of industry, and there were a lot of kind of sitting in mobile huts in industrial estates in the middle of nowhere. So not very much glamour and not very much job satisfaction for me personally. So once I'd qualified, I spent the last 12 months of my time with Deloitte's. I asked to do a secondment to their training division, and I spent 12 months delivering training to new graduates who just fresh out of higher education and taking up a graduate training opportunity with Deloitte's. And that was a fantastic time. I absolutely loved it, and I really found the job satisfaction that I'd been missing in my previous role. So that's really what led me to the HE sector. I enjoyed that so much. I started looking for roles within higher education. Initially, I'll be honest, thinking about delivering learning and teaching. I'd so much enjoyed the delivery side of the role with Deloitte's, but actually fell into a professional services administrative role, which was at the University of Liverpool, working in their planning and development department. And that was back in 2002. So I did that role. And really since then, I've basically worked my way up and around, and I've really had the benefit of working in lots of different parts of universities. And I know in some of your previous podcasts, you've talked about kind of the Warwick way. And I suppose, whilst I don't think it was a deliberate strategy for Liverpool at the time where I started my career, that was really the kind of path I followed, and that I had the opportunity to move around and work in lots of different departments, seeing things from a central administration point of view, and then out in a faculty in a school, working in finance, research, and latterly in a faculty leadership role. Yeah. And then I've also sort of focused throughout my HE career up to date more and more with an increased focus on health and life sciences. And so I took the opportunity to get much more proactively involved in interactions with the NHS. So one of my roles that I moved on to in Manchester was Chief Operating Officer of the Manchester Academic Health Science Centre. So very much working at the heart of the interaction and the interfaces between universities, NHS organisations and industry. And that's been really fascinating. And then my immediate role prior to coming here to Belfast for a new adventure for the family and I was the Director of Operations at the University of Manchester, again, in a Faculty of Biology, Medicine and Health. But that role, such a large faculty at Manchester, really gave me a good grounding and some great experience to prepare me for my first role as Registrar and Chief Operating Officer here in Belfast.
So you, I mean, it's a very, you know, kind of very broad range of duties, as you say, which kind of enabled you to pick up all of that, you know, the range of skills and experiences you kind of need to have a good grounding from when you come into kind of registrar COO role. But I wonder about your kind of health service experience and whether, you know, we'll leave aside the audit work, which I'm sure there are many who share your joy at that. But the health service stuff, you know, did that help give you a kind of different perspective coming into your role as registrar COO? Because it seems to me it would be really quite valuable.
Absolutely. It's been so beneficial for me. And, you know, working in the Academic Health Science Centre gave me an opportunity to understand the synergies and the added value we could get from really working across systems and trying to break down some of our silos. I know within universities, we're constantly battling with, you know, trying to break down our own internal silos within our organisations, getting better communication, getting more integration. But seeing how that worked across systems and across different sectors was really beneficial. And just up until moving here to Belfast 12 months ago, I also was privileged to have the opportunity to work as a non-executive director at Aintree University Hospitals in Liverpool. And getting that board level experience, again, was fantastic development. And what it really showed me was it gave me a much broader perspective on some of the challenges we're facing within our own sector. And some of that put things into context about, you know, how over the decades I've worked in HE, some of the challenges we feel we're facing, we always look at within the context of HE. And actually comparing that to some of the challenges that the health service have been through over recent years really did put things into perspective. Yeah. And it gave me an opportunity to see how the NHS are having to be innovative, because the money is simply there and the patients don't stop coming. So it's not like us with student numbers where we can choose to take more or less at any point in time. The patients just keep turning up. And so they have to find innovative models of delivery. And a lot of that involves partnership. So the opportunity to get exposed to more partnership working has been really beneficial for me. And I'm trying to put that into practice in my role here in Belfast. Yeah.
And of course, in normal circumstances, you know, that would be, you know, really helpful and give you a really good platform to be creative and innovative. But these are, you know, very, very unusual circumstances. And I guess, you know, very unusual for the NHS, very unusual for higher education as well. And I mean, how would you say that your university has you know, has coped since the start of the kind of pandemic challenge? Has it been incredibly difficult? Have people responded well?
Yeah, I mean, it's been a huge challenge for all of us, hasn't it, across the globe in all different sectors. So there's no doubt it's been challenging for our staff and our students and our wider community. I think as a university and a sector as a whole within higher education, we have responded really well. I think there's been a little bit of a surprise at how readily we've managed to adapt and how our technology infrastructure has supported us in that. There are things that, and I know Queen's is not alone in this, you know, we delivered the last two weeks of teaching before Easter entirely online. And if I'd asked that question 2 weeks prior, everybody would have said it was an absolute impossibility and it would have taken 3 years to get to that position. And, you know, we did it in a matter of weeks.
Yeah.
So people have shown huge engagement, huge commitment. They've been very agile and they've had to be extremely resilient. What we're finding now within the university, and again, I'm sure that we're not alone in this, actually moving to lockdown and the remote working was, at the time, it didn't feel easy, but was probably the easier part of this, because a bit like that NHS experience when a patient turns up at the door, we had no option, we had to do it. Now, as we're starting to think about return to campus, you know, this is probably more challenging than that early phase. I think we responded really well to the early phase and people were running with a lot of adrenaline. And now we're needing to start to face the challenge about how do we work in different ways and how do we face all these challenges that are coming to us in a sustainable way, in a way where people don't get burnt out. So very much for us, part of our thinking at the moment is about well-being and how we support staff and students and our communities through this in a way that protects that and is more sustainable.
That's absolutely right. I'm really interested in the well-being point there, because I mean, your description of people kind of running on adrenaline for that first period is absolutely correct, and then immediately, of course, you, at some point, you know, you have to come down off that adrenaline high, and there's a danger then that everyone sinks into despondency. But the kind of looking after people remotely is really challenging, isn't it? So what ways are you approaching that? How are you supporting staff across the institution?
Yeah, it is challenging. So we're trying to take a holistic approach to it. So we encourage all of our teams to make sure that they make space for that regular team contact. So over and above the normal kind of running the business and the committee cycles, making sure that teams find time to come together, albeit virtually, and have maybe a bit more of that relaxed time for discussion that isn't against a strict agenda, and time just to check in on each other and make sure, you know, how are things, how are the family, how are you finding the remote working, you know, those conversations you might normally have in the tea room or in the corridor pre and post meetings. And then we're also working very hard to make sure some of the things that staff might rely on campus as a way of helping manage their well-being. So, you know, online exercise programs. We have a university choir, which is part of our wellbeing agenda, and the choir is meeting remotely. And that's, I can say from personal experience, as someone who enjoys singing, you know, choir on Zoom is a very interesting experience. my children think it's hilarious because obviously they can hear me and they can't hear the rest of the choir. Things like that, you know, that are really important, and sometimes they're the things that get people through a busy week. Just having targeted time out, whether it's to do exercise, whether it's just to have a chat or to engage in some other activities. And then at the moment we're having a really serious conversation, and this is right at the top level with the University Executive Board, about how we might need to put a bit of new discipline around how we work, because for everyone with working at home, that work-life balance, the boundaries have blurred so much. We want people to have the flexibility to work at times and in modes that suit them, but then we need to be able to have time where we all switch off and we're not constantly turned on 24/7.
No, I absolutely agree with that. And I mean, similarly, at Nottingham, we're having those discussions, but it is really, really difficult because, you know, part of it is about thinking what will the working pattern be when we return in some form, and maybe not everyone will be on campus all at the same time. So will that mean that, you know, the working day is very different for some people? But part of it is absolutely ensuring that people take time out, and that means taking your holidays, you know, not working, you know, every evening, every day, every weekend, because otherwise people will burn out. But that does require, you know, instruction as well as self-discipline. And that's, you know, that is really hard when we're also expecting people to respond, you know, round the clock to electronic messages of one kind or another. And the balance there is very, very difficult to strike. So whether you do it through, you know, having, you know, days of no meetings, etc., or constraining the times meetings can happen, or, you know, just, you know, not allowing any emails to be sent overnight. I don't know, but it is really, really difficult.
It is difficult, and so it kind of needs to be a dialogue. So we've talked about, you know, are there rules we can put in the technology, which there are through things like Microsoft Outlook, where people can work at a time that suits them, but the system controls when that might be received at the other end. There are some factors we need to take into account of that. Obviously, as a university, we're doing work with collaborators and colleagues all around the globe, and they work to different time slots to us. Yeah. So we're having to factor all of that in. But the most important thing is, I think, that the leadership are role modeling that this is an important conversation for us to have. There's no one size fits all, but it's important that we're having the dialogue within the university.
Yeah. Thinking about what that means for, I mean, okay, that, you know, we can come up with something that maybe get us through the next, you know, 3 to 6 months. But thinking about, you know, a year on, when we're you know, it's, you know, assuming we're, you know, everything's functioning normally-ish in the university, do you think it will have an impact on how we actually construct normal working lives, as it were? And I'm thinking particularly in professional services, where, you know, actually what this shows us is we don't need everyone on campus at the same time, and we don't need to focus on people just being, you know, present to confirm that they're actually doing work, which has often been our kind of traditional approach in professional services. So do you think we'll reconfigure how we see our roles in professional services?
I do, absolutely. And we're already having that conversation, you know, and I'm sure you are at Nottingham as well. And I think there's a real agreement that we want to take the opportunities that have come out of this pandemic and this crisis, and that we've demonstrated that we can work in very different ways, and that we can be very agile and adapt very quickly. So we really want to see if we can, if you like, capitalize on those opportunities, but at the same time as trying to just manage the return to some kind of normality for people. So there are areas where I think the remote working has highlighted to us we can do things much more efficiently than we have traditionally done within the university. And those things that we do more efficiently now online, we will continue to do. So we won't want to lose that. Equally, there are other areas where it's clearly far from ideal and we're missing out on a lot of added value by working in the way we are remotely. And so those will be the things that we'll be prioritising to get back to doing in a face-to-face model. And one of the challenges we're facing is where do you get the balance right between how much you set as kind of an institutional framework and you prescribe for the institution, and how much do you leave down to local decision making? Because actually so much of this is not a one size fits all. Yeah. And it really needs to be very carefully understood in terms of the local impact of some of those decisions. And there's a balance, isn't there? Because if you devolve too much, there's a risk that you get real variation, and that could drive inequalities, which is something we're very mindful of. We want to manage this return to whatever it is we're returning to in a way that's equitable. But equally, if you're too prescriptive as an institution, it doesn't necessarily work for local units or areas.
I absolutely get that. But also going back to your earlier point about the need for, in, you know, times of constraint, actually the need for greater innovation on the ground. You do want people to feel empowered to come up with creative solutions to the problems that they're facing very, very locally, and to work their way around them in a way that actually makes sense in the context of what they're trying to do. So you want to kind of stimulate innovation and creativity rather than constrain it and, you know, ensure that you put it in a straitjacket.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's no doubt that this whole crisis has been a catalyst in that, and it's really accelerated innovation in parts of our portfolio. So there are real benefits coming out of it, despite the fact that, you know, it's a terrible time and there's clearly a lot of terrible tragedy around the loss of life.
The one of the things that's intrigued me a little bit over the past couple of months is the kind of different approaches that the different nations within the UK have taken in Wales, Scotland and Northern Ireland. And, you know, and it, on the whole, everyone's moving broadly in the same direction, but there are different decisions being made, you know, in Northern Ireland versus England about, you know, the kind of, I mean, so I couldn't tell you whether or not, you know, you've currently got non-essential shops open, or people are allowed to engage with another household with one person in it, or in their own bubble, or whatever. So the rules are slightly different. So how, I mean, how's that playing out for you? I mean, does it make life harder when you've got, you know, different rules?
I don't think the rules themselves make life harder, but I think we constantly feel, and this is probably the same for the other devolved administrations as well, that there is sometimes a battle to articulate, what, particularly when we're talking about a UK-wide position, that there are yeah, different contexts and there are different local arrangements and devolved administrations that mean that a UK-wide solution doesn't always work as well for us here in Northern Ireland. So, you know, the admissions has been a piece that we've had to spend more time than we would like on, not in terms of we clearly want to, yeah, to admit students, but trying to raise the level of understanding about the different contexts. So here in Northern Ireland, our student numbers are capped. And they always have been. So that's very different, yeah, to say in England, where up until the recent changes, you were operating without a cap. So there are challenges for us, I think, around the Northern Ireland context. So not so much around the relaxation, you know, and how many people can you have in a meeting outdoors, which I think, although it changes daily, is 10 people outside, yeah, now in Northern Ireland.
Oh, right. So it's almost you can almost have a committee meeting outside.
Absolutely. But it's more around the devolved administration and how that impacts on how we operate, and I suppose the levels of autonomy. You know, we make it very clear that we're an autonomous institution, but we are operating within different rules in terms of accountability than England is, for example.
Right. So in terms of thinking then forward about, you know, kind of, I was going to say reopening, because that's wrong, because actually one way or another, we've all been open. We may have had closed parts of campuses, but actually universities have been open, as you said earlier, teaching students since lockdown. But so in terms of though of the start of the next session and welcoming new and returning students, which, you know, institutions, you know, are all planning for at the moment, are there particular hurdles you have to cross with the devolved government in order to ensure that you're able to do what you want this autumn, bearing in mind it's still months away and you know, people are watching, you know, Premiership football on telly now?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's the pace has really accelerated of the relaxation of the lockdown restrictions. And so things that might have been a big concern for us 2 weeks ago are already less of a concern. Yeah. I mean, one of the key things still, so we have committed to starting term as normal on the 21st of September and delivering, yeah, as much teaching as possible face to face within the public health guidelines. So recognising, yeah, that if there's still a 2 metre social distancing, then that's going to limit physically how many people we can bring on campus and teach face to face. And there's a lot of talk now, you know, I know across the UK, across all of the nations, about moving from 2 metres to 1 metre and, you know, the scientific position around that as to whether it's safe or not. But that would make a huge difference to us being 1 metre rather than two in terms of the capacity to deliver teaching face to face. Other things, I think the restrictions that have been relaxed by the Northern Ireland Executive do mean that we're more confident that campus experience, that, you know, is a big part of what students come for university for, they will be able to experience some of that, albeit it will be with restrictions and appropriate safeguards in place. So we are hoping that the sports centre will be able to be open. We're planning to open the library from the 3rd of August. We will be opening cafes and catering venues, and all of that is in line with the plans that have been set out by the Northern Ireland Executive. So the real constraint really is the social distancing and the 2 metre, 1 metre, or if that's completely relaxed at some stage.
Yeah, who knows? And yeah, part of the challenge, of course, for all of us at the moment is planning for those different possibilities come late September. And I guess the other challenge is that, the recruitment of international students, which we've all depended upon, or many universities have depended upon as a kind of vital contributor to their mission, but also as a source of finance as well. And at the moment the numbers may look okay on paper, but a lot of the survey data indicates that many of them won't come. What's your kind of feeling about the challenge of international student recruitment and how that will play out? Do you think they will come? Do you think they will wait and see? Do you think the messages are overdone and actually the UK, despite our saying we're going to quarantine them and what have you, that it will all be okay?
It's really interesting, isn't it? I don't think any of us really know how this will pan out. So all of our management information and our data is suggesting that it's not going to be as bad as we feared. And for Queen's, in terms of overall the impact on our income, we've modelled a very wide range from best case scenario being 30 million down on income and worst case scenario being 80 to 90 million down on income. So a huge range there. And all our data around, student acceptances, students continuing to pay deposits, students registering for accommodation in halls of residence would tell us it's veering towards the best case scenario. But I think there's still a lot of deep rooted nervousness about, yes, that's what the data is saying, but will they actually convert? Will they actually come? And for some of the international students, will they physically be able to travel and get here? And we do know for some of our international cohorts that the online mode of learning is not attractive to them. Yeah. So, for some particular in-country groups, they would probably prefer a delayed entry or a deferred entry than a term of having, an online learning experience. So there's still a lot of nervousness, but our data is telling us that it's more positive than perhaps we're feeling.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. But the truth of these things is always when people actually arrive or don't, and you never count your chickens.
We're quite fortunate here in Northern Ireland in that our rates of infection and our death rates have been relatively low. So that is something that, understandably, we're using as part of our marketing to the overseas community, that this is a safe place to come.
Outrageous. Yeah, we've got the Irish Sea between us and the rest of the UK. So you'll be all right if you come to Northern Ireland. Yeah.
Well, there has to be some benefits. I mean, another big risk for us is we've got Brexit looming very quickly around the corner. Yeah. But the Irish Sea offers advantages as well as disadvantages.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, Joanne, because I mean, one of the things that shamefully I don't really know is how much collaboration you get on the island of Ireland and with your counterparts in the Republic. I mean, do Queen's and Ulster do a lot of work with universities in the Republic? And will that change in future as a result of new border arrangements?
Yeah, so I mean, there is a lot of really good collaboration that goes on at the level of individual researcher and individual research groups. I think over the last probably 18 months, we're seeing much more joining up at a strategic level and recognising the mutual benefits of collaboration. But I mean, there's a lot in this space, and it's been a steep learning curve for me as someone coming in new to Northern Ireland and learning the landscape. Whilst I knew the higher education sector, that there's a lot that's unique to Northern Ireland. And some of that, unfortunately, has become politicised. And as a university, we need to try and stay out of the political arguments and focus on the impact of those collaborations and how it will offer benefit to society more broadly in terms of the jointly collaborative work we're doing. But I think we are seeing that starting to be greater connectivity at a strategic level. And that's not just across the island in that sort of north-south dimension, but, you know, across between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK on that east-west dimension as well. Collaboration is going to be absolutely key for all of us coming out of this.
No, I completely agree. And I mean, although we are diverse, we are still a sector. And, you know, we are still universities broadly trying to do the same thing broadly, you know, in the interests of the people of the country and the country and its economy more generally. And thinking, you know, long term, I mean, it's, you know, it's a pretty pessimistic prognosis for the next, you know, few months or year or so. But thinking longer term, what's your kind of long term view of how things will pan out? Will we look similar as a sector in 3-5 years time as we do now? Or will things have changed radically? And will we be loved by government in a way that we possibly aren't at the moment, do you think? What does the future hold? I struggle, to be honest, with fortune
telling. Well, I was going to say, are you wearing your rose tinted glasses there? do you know, I honestly think that some good things will come out of this. I think as a sector, and we certainly see this here in Northern Ireland, there's a very clear acceptance of the role that universities play in driving the economy. So I think that's unquestioned, but there's still, for me, a big piece of work to do around the hearts and minds and people really appreciating the value that the higher education sector brings to society more generally. I know it was mentioned in one of your previous podcasts around, you know, the fact that we train the doctors and the nurses and the healthcare professions, we train the teachers, etc. And I think sometimes some of that is overlooked, and we do need to work hard to break down some of those barriers and still the perception around the elitism that exists in part of the sector. I think personally that this crisis will force us to focus more. And it's been one of my personal bugbears as a sector within higher education. I don't think we're always great at focusing and narrowing things down to a smaller number of priorities. Whilst a number of us run comprehensive universities from a learning and teaching perspective, we can't all be all things to all people. Yeah. And we have to play to our strengths. And so along with that increased focus that I think we'll see and the increase in levels of innovation that we've already talked about, I do think we'll see increased levels of collaboration in all forms. So whether that's formal partnerships or informal partnerships, I think we will see much more of that going forward than perhaps we have previously.
Great. Well, on that optimistic, very positive note, we'll stop there. Joanne, thank you. That's been a really super conversation. I've really enjoyed talking to you about some of the challenges, but also the optimistic future lying ahead for our sector. So thank you very much indeed for your time.
Thanks, Paul. It's been really good to talk with you.
That's all then from University Registrars talking about stuff this time. There'll be plenty more along in due course, and if you can't wait, then please do check out the Registrarism blog on wonky.com, where you'll find lots of higher education comment and fun and games. Until next time.